So today is the last day at my retreats. On the last day, I always tell yogis, today is the last day and let's do the best, or let's make the best. But today, I was requested to explain jhana and jnana, two things. Since you have studied the consciousness, mental factors, and also the classification of consciousness by way of feelings and so on, you already understand what jhana is and what jnana is. These two words are close to each other in sound, jhana and jnana. You all know again that there are two kinds of jhana, form sphere jhana and formless sphere jhana. And again, the commentaries explain that vipassana can be called jhana, magga or path can be called jhana, and phala or fruition can be called jhana. So there can be a little confusion about this. When we say jhana, we usually mean the rupavachara jhana and arupavachara jhana. But according to the explanation given in the commentary, vipassana can also be jhana. So some vipassana experience can be called jhana, but I think putting jhana in vipassana is open to misunderstanding. But first, let us talk about jhana. So jhana means observing the object closely. And in order to develop jhana, you need a strong concentration. So if you have no concentration, then you cannot expect to get jhana. The jhanas are described in the texts, in the discourses as well as in the Midama, in another way than what we are familiar with through the manual, this manual of Abhidhamma. Whenever Buddha described jhana, he said, quite secluded from sense pleasures or sense objects, quite secluded from unwholesome states, a monk attains and dwells in the jhana and so on, first jhana and so on. So in order to get jhana, you need seclusion from sense objects, seclusion from sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touch that are desirable. So first we need seclusion from these sense objects that are conditions for sense pleasures to arise, or that are conditioned for attachment to sense pleasures to arise. And that we achieve by going to a suitable place for meditation, not among objects that could distract us. So that is called bodily seclusion. So bodily seclusion means going to a place where there are no distractions of sense pleasures. So the best place for this kind of practice is in a forest. And Buddha said, quite secluded from unwholesome states. By this phrase is meant mental seclusion. So there are first two kinds of seclusion, bodily seclusion and mental seclusion. Mental seclusion means the mind being free from mental hindrances. So when mind is free from mental hindrances, it is free from unwholesome states. And so in the description of jhana, Buddha said, quite secluded from unwholesome states. In order to be secluded from unwholesome states, we have to practice meditation. So we try to keep our mind on one object, and when we can keep the mind on the object and prevent the mental hindrances from arising, we are said to be mentally secluded. Now, when we practice meditation, these mental hindrances can come to us quite often. When we practice meditation, we want to get something. We are attached to results. We want enlightenment. And so when there are such desires, we cannot concentrate, because this desire is a block to our progress. Or if we want some worldly things also when we are practicing meditation, then this desire for the objects will block our practice. But sometimes, even though when we are practicing, we are angry. Somebody makes a noise and we are angry, or it is too hot and we are angry, or it is too cold and we are angry, or a mosquito bites you and you are angry. So there are so many things that can irritate us. And when we are angry, we are out of meditation. The moment anger comes into our mind, we are not in meditation. So anger or ill will, or sometimes we are depressed or discouraged. So all these are the different forms of ill will. And when this ill will arises, then we cannot meditate. So ill will is also a hindrance to the practice. When we are able to prevent ill will from arising, then we are said to be mentally secluded. Sometimes we are practicing meditation and we feel sleepy. We may nod again and again. So we try to keep our minds on the object, but we cannot. So sleepiness is another mental hindrance. Every yogi has this problem. Sometimes they report that they could not get rid of sleepiness. So when sleepiness comes, your mind becomes blurry and dull, and so you cannot see the object clearly. And so there is a kind of unclearness in seeing the object. Sometimes your mind does not seem to be stuck to the object. Your mind is like wavering above the object. Now, your mind does not go to other objects, but your mind is not on the meditation object and sticking to it either. So that is called restlessness, restlessness of mind. So when there is restlessness of mind, that means when mind cannot be on the object squarely or stuck to the object, we cannot meditate. So this restlessness is also a mental hindrance. And sometimes we may feel remorse, something because we did something wrong in the past, or we did not do something good in the past. And then we are sorry for that, and there is regret or remorse. When there is remorse in our mind, again, we cannot practice. So remorse is also a hindrance. Sometimes when we are practicing meditation and we cannot get concentration, then we begin to doubt. We begin to doubt the practice, or we begin to doubt the instructions given by the teacher and so on. And when there is doubt, you cannot go on meditating. So you are out of meditation at that time. And this is also a hindrance. So there are these hindrances arising in our mind quite often when we practice meditation. But we persevere, and little by little, we are able to keep these mental hindrances away. Then we begin to attain mental seclusion. So when our minds are free from these hindrances, our mind is said to be secluded. This mental seclusion is also important. Without the mental seclusion, or without being away from mental hindrances, concentration cannot be achieved. So whenever Buddha described a monk and abiding in the jhana, especially the first jhana, he said, quite secluded from sense pleasures and quite secluded from unwholesome states. So these are the prerequisites for getting into jhana. And then the first jhana is described as accompanied by vitakka and vichara. So you all know vitakka and vichara. Vitakka is a mental state that takes the mind to the object and put the mind on the object. And vichara is another mental state that keeps the mind engaged on the object. In order to get jhana, these two mental states are necessary. So you direct your mind to the object, and then vitakka takes the mind to the object and put it on the object. And then vichara keep it engaged on the object. When I explained to you the Rupa Vajracheda, I gave a simile. Analogy. Now, when you want to clean a bowl or a cup, say, which is stained or soiled, then you firmly grip the bowl with one hand, and then with the other hand, some cloth or whatever in the hand, you rub the bowl. So only when you grip firmly and rub the bowl can the bowl become clean. So in the same way, when you practice meditation, your mind must take hold of the object firmly, and that your mind should be on the object as it were massaging the object or rubbing the object. Now, vichara is said to be rubbing the object or massaging the object. That is, it gets itself engaged on the object. And also it is said that there is a kind of rapture or PD when you get into this jhana. And there is also what is called happiness. So that is how the first jhana is explained in the text. So in order to get jhana, we need to have bodily seclusion and mental seclusion. So when we get mental seclusion, we also experience the seclusion of keeping mental defilements away for some time. When the mental defilements are away, when our minds are free from mental defilements, we experience what is called joy through being away from mental defilements. But in order to get jhana, the most important thing is concentration or one-pointedness of mind. One-pointedness of mind is not mentioned in the description of the first jhana. But, as you know, there are five jhana factors: vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata, one-pointedness of mind or concentration. So when these factors become stronger and stronger, mind is able to be on the meditation object, and there is no distraction, or mind is not distracted to other objects. So when mind is able to be on the meditation object firmly and going deep into it, then what is called apana or jhana arises. And jhana is called jhana because it observes the object closely, and also it burns the mental hindrances. That means when there is jhana, mental hindrances cannot arise. So jhana is said to burn the mental hindrances. If you want to get jhana, you practice samatha meditation. There are 40 subjects of samatha meditation. There are some subjects of samatha meditation that do not lead to attainment of jhana. For example, recollection of the virtues of the Buddha. If you practice that meditation, you will not get jhana. You will get only what is called excess concentration or neighborhood concentration. That is because the object, the virtues of the Buddha or the qualities of the Buddha are so profound, and they are mostly ultimate realities. Through that type of meditation, one cannot get absorption or jhana. So if you want to get jhana, you practice the subjects that lead to jhana. For example, you practice kasina meditation. Kasina meditation means you make a disc of earth, for example, and then look at it and memorize it and try to get the image in your mind and so on. So if you want to get jhana, you practice samatha meditation. Then what about vipassana meditation? If we use the word jhana to mean the rupa vajra jhana or arupa vajra jhana, then you cannot get jhana through vipassana meditation. Vipassana meditation does not lead to attainment of jhana. Vipassana meditation leads to penetration into the nature of things. Vipassana meditation can help you to see the true nature of things, to see the common characteristics of conditioned phenomena, that is, to see the three characteristics: impermanence, suffering, and non-soul. So, if we use the word jhana to mean rupa vajra and arupa vajra jhana, then you cannot get jhana through the practice of vipassana meditation. Now, in this respect, Mahasi Siyaro talked about experiences that are like jhana experiences while practicing vipassana meditation. So in vipassana experience, there are some experiences that are like jhana experiences. In his talks, Mahasi Searaw explained this. So you practice vipassana meditation, and at some point your practice resembles the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, and the fourth jhana. That means the experience that you have during the practice of vipassana meditation is like the jhana experience, but not the real jhana experience. Because real jhana, or rupa vajra jhana and arupa vajra jhana, cannot be obtained through vipassana meditation. So Searaw said, the three lakanas are anicca lakana, dukkha lakana, and anatta lakana. So lakana means characteristics. Observing these three signs means vipassana jhana. So Searaw explains that what he called vipassana jhana is just seeing the three characteristics. So when you see the three characteristics, you are doing vipassana. And that Searaw called vipassana jhana. So here, vipassana jhana does not mean that there is rupa vajra or arupa vajra jhana in vipassana. But there are experiences that resemble jhana experience. But one cannot possibly start with observation of these three lakanas or characteristics. That means the moment you sit down and practice meditation, you will not see the three characteristics. So in order to see the three characteristics, you have to make effort, you have to practice mindfulness, you have to observe the objects that are at the present moment. So one must start observing the consciousness emanating from the six sense doors of the body. That means your mind, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and so on, or wandering mind, and many other mental states. To observe the actions of the body, one must make a note of them as they occur. So that is, when you are doing the body contemplation of the body meditation, so going, lifting of the foot, moving forward of the foot, dropping of the foot as one is walking. In the same way, one must note the standing, sitting, sleeping, bending, stretching, rising of the abdomen, and its falling, seeing, hearing, etc., all actions as they occur. So this is what you do when you practice vipassana meditation. While noting these actions of the body and the mind as they occur, one will come to know of the new occurrence or happening of the actions. That means arising and disappearing of the actions, and also the passing out of these actions to be followed by a new series of actions. You practice vipassana meditation. First, you try to be mindful of the object at the present moment, mostly the in-breath and out-breath or the movements of the abdomen. So in the beginning, you do not yet see the three characteristics. But you try to keep your mind on the object and be mindful of the object, paying just bare attention to the objects. Then a time will come when you see the three characteristics, when you see the objects arising and disappearing, and so you come to see that these objects are impermanent and they are suffering or distress or misery, and there is no control over them. So when a yogi begins to see these three characteristics, there is a kind of mental activity. Now, when teachers give instruction for vipassana meditation, they will say, just be mindful of the object, do not think about the object. But at this stage, you cannot help thinking. First, you see the impermanent nature, suffering nature, and non-soul nature of the object you observe, and then you may think that just as this object is impermanent, so were the objects in the past, and so will be the objects in the future. This kind of thinking goes on at this stage of vipassana meditation. So during this stage of vipassana meditation, there is a lot of activity of vitakka and vichara. You see directly the object at the present moment as impermanent and so on, and then you think that just as this is impermanent, others will be impermanent too, something like that. So there is a kind of mental activity going on, and this mental activity is actually the activity of vitakka and vichara. So that stage is like, so the mindfulness of this state of affairs in the physical and mental phenomena takes the meditator to the beginning of sammasana jnana. That is the first vipassana knowledge, comprehension of mind and body. That means seeing mind and body as impermanent and so on. So at this stage, the yogi will make a note of any movement or action, physical or mental, over and over, and thus derive measure of peaceful happiness that is born of samadhi. So during this stage, a yogi, because he can now note any movement or any action or any object, he becomes peaceful, and so he enjoys a kind of happiness. And that happiness is the result of mind being concentrated. So it is born of samadhi. So this kind of concentration is called ekagata samadhi, and this state is equivalent to the first stage of jhana. So it is not jhana, but it is like jhana. It is similar to the experience of first jhana, because in first jhana there are vitakka and vichara. Although mind is stuck to the object, there is some kind of mental activity. Vitakka, putting the mind on the object, and vichara, keeping the mind engaged on the object, or like vichara, rubbing. In vipassana experience also, at this stage, there is this kind of thinking. So this stage, the stage of sammasana jnana, the comprehension of mind and matter, is equivalent to the first stage of jhana. In the next stage, as the yogi progresses, the actions and movements will present themselves spontaneously for noting. That means, in the beginning, a yogi has made firm effort to be mindful and to see the impermanent nature and so on of the objects. When he reaches the next stage, the actions and movements will present themselves spontaneously for noting. So he does not have to make much effort to note the objects, because the objects, as it were, present themselves to his mind. So when he is able to note, he is able to be mindful of the object without much effort, he has passed the first stage in which he has to make an effort to note them. And this next stage of insight is called Uddiyabhaya Jnana. Uddiyabhaya means rising and falling, and jnana means knowledge. So knowledge of rising and falling. So at this stage, a yogi sees the objects arising and disappearing. Whatever object he observes, he sees that the object arises and it disappears. So when a yogi begins to see the arising and disappearing or rise and fall of the object, there is no thinking of the object and there is no here wandering of the mind, which is vichara. So they are absent. Absent means they are not actively functioning at this moment. And piti and sukha, rapture and joyfulness, abound with a further strengthening of samadhi. So samadhi or concentration becomes stronger, and at the same time a yogi experiences rapture or joy, because now he is able to see the rise and fall of objects clearly in his mind, and so he becomes happy. He is joyful, he is rapturous. And so at this stage is the earlier part of Uddiyabhaya Jnana. Now, we divide this knowledge of rise and fall into two, the early part and then later mature part. So during this early part of Uddiyabhaya Jnana, stage of insight, the experience is again equivalent to the second jhana stage. Now you all know that there are no vitaka and vichara in second jhana if we take four jhanas and not five jhanas. So in the fourfold method, the first jhana is accompanied by vitaka and vichara, and second jhana is not accompanied by vitaka and vichara. So in the second jhana, vitaka and vichara are absent. Similarly, at this stage of the early part of knowledge of rise and fall, there is no activity of vitaka and vichara. There is no thinking. Now the yogi is just watching the object or taking the object as it arises and disappears, and seeing the arising and disappearing. Since there is no thinking like during the stage of sammasana jnana, comprehending the mind and matter, it is equivalent to the second jhana stage. At the advanced stage of Uddiyabhaya jnana, now there's a mistake. Typo error. So I try to be perfect, but I can never be perfect. There is at least one typing error or some error in my handout. But I'm glad that, because that means I'm still human. To err is human, right? So, so at the advanced stage of Uddiyabhaya Jnana, knowledge of rise and fall, the light emanating from the state of joy will be overcome by sukha and samadhi, peaceful happiness and concentration. During the early stage of the knowledge of rise and fall, a yogi experiences the light or illumination, and he has a lot of piti, and he has much energy and so on. But these subside when he reaches the advanced stage of knowledge of rise and fall. Because when the light and other states become evident, a yogi is to watch these states or to make notes of these states. A yogi is not to take delight in these states. If a yogi takes delight in these states, like when he sees the illumination and so on, he will be stuck there and he will not be able to make any progress. So he is instructed to just watch them, to just be mindful of them or make mental notes of them, so that he is able to transcend them or he is able to overcome them. So at this stage, these states that arise during the early stage of knowledge of rise and fall disappear. And sukha, peacefulness, and samadhi, concentration, have become prominent. So that means there is no PD now. So it is like, or it is equivalent to, the third stage of jhana, or the third jhana. Now, the third jhana is without PD. Again, first jhana is with vitaka, vichara, PD, sukha. Second jhana, without vitaka and vichara, but with PD and sukha. Now, the third jhana, there is no PD. So here also, the PD or rupture that arose during the early stage of knowledge of rise and fall disappears. So only peacefulness and concentration remain. And so this stage is like the third jhana stage. Then further, even sukha dims and fades when attention is focused on the constant decay and passing out of the phenomena as bhanga jnana. So bhanga means the dissolution or breaking, and jnana is knowledge of the dissolution, knowledge of breaking. The insight on decay and destruction develops. So from the advanced stage of uddiyabhaya jnana, a yogi reaches the stage of bhanga jnana. That means at this stage, he sees falling or disappearance more clearly than the arising. At this stage, he's seeing objects disappearing. Whatever object he takes, that he sees the disappearance of or dissolution of that object. So when he sees the dissolution or breaking up of all the objects he observes, there arose in him what is called indifference. Now he is not attached to it. He has no delight in these experiences, but there is a kind of equanimity in him, and that stands out prominently at this stage. And that stage is equivalent to the fourth stage of jhana. Now the fourth jhana, that means the fifth, according to the fivefold method. So the fourth jhana is even without sukha. There is only upekkha and ekagata. There are only these two in the fourth jhana according to fourfold method, and in the fifth jhana according to fivefold method. Now Sato is using here fourfold method. So this stage of vipassana, the stage of knowledge of dissolution, is equivalent to or like the fourth jhana in rupa vajra jhanas. In fact, upekkha and ekagata become more prominent in the higher stage of inside knowledge called sankharupekkha jnana. This is almost the top of different stages of knowledge in vipassana. So in that stage, the stage of equanimity about formations, the indifference or equanimity and ekagata, one-pointedness, become more prominent. So until that stage is equivalent to the fourth stage of jhana. So by this, Searo explains to us that there can be experiences like jhana in the practice of vipassana meditation. So they are not jhana if we use the word jhana to mean rupa vajra and arupa vajra jhana. So I call them jhana-like experiences in vipassana. Now, the commentary said that vipassana can also be called jhana, magga can also be called jhana, and phala or fruition can also be called jhana. Vipassana can be called jhana because vipassana observes closely the three characteristics. Now, rupavacara jhana and arupavacara jhana are called jhana because they closely observe the objects. Vipassana is called jhana because it closely observes the three characteristics. And magga, which is the outcome of vipassana, is also called jhana because the work done by vipassana comes to be accomplished through magga. So when magga is reached, vipassana comes to an end, and so that means the observation of the three characteristics come to an end. So magga is also called jhana. And phala, fruition, is also called jhana because it examines closely the characteristic of nibbana, or characteristic of cessation. So, according to this explanation in the commentary, vipassana can also be jhana, magga can also be called jhana, phala also can be called jhana. So we may use, or we may call, the experiences just mentioned as vipassana jhana. But as I said in the beginning, using the word vipassana jhana is open to misunderstanding. So if you do not qualify, if you just say there are vipassana jhanas, people may think that in vipassana also there are rupavacara jhanas and arupavacara jhanas. And why there can be no rupavacara jhana and arupavacara jhana in vipassana? Now, rupavacara jhana and arupavacara jhana takes objects like concepts and some ultimate reality as object. But vipassana takes miscellaneous formations as object. So their objects are different. Since their objects are different, one cannot be called by the name of the other. So the rupavacara jhanas and arupavacara jhanas take the mostly concepts as object, and vipassana takes the three characteristics as object, or the conditioned phenomena which have these three characteristics. So when it is one, it cannot be the other. So vipassana cannot be jhana, and jhana cannot be vipassana, if we take jhana to mean rupavacara jhana and arupavacara jhana. Now, I was thinking, why the commentaries explain like this to make us confused? In the discourses, sometimes the word jhana is used to mean also vipassana. There is a verse in Dhammapada which says, "You yourselves must make the effort." Most of you are familiar with that saying, right? "You yourselves must make the effort. Tathagatas are only teachers or proclaimers." And then, "Those who have entered the path and examined closely by jhanas will get free from the bond of Mara." Now here the word jhana is used. And it said, "You will get free from the bond of Mara." That means you will attain enlightenment. So here jhana cannot mean rupavacara or arupavacara jhana only. So here the commentary said, "Examine closely by two kinds of jhanas." And two kinds of jhanas means rupavacara and arupavacara jhana on the one hand, and vipassana and magga on the other. So in some places, Jhana can mean not Rupa Vajra and Arupa Vajra Jhana only, but also Vipassana, Magga, and so on. Commentaries explain that Vipassana, Magga, and Phala can also be Jhana. So we must understand this clearly, and when we talk about it or when we use the term Jhana, it is good to define it before we talk. So I'm using the word Jhana in this sense or in that sense.